Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by Look Forward, the podcast from Rathbones on what the future might look like. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. Today the Prime Minister will be speaking at a conference about the need for a vaccine as a global effort. In comments the Prime Minister will make, he is due to say that the route back to full normality requires a vaccine. James, given that a vaccine is expected to take at minimum a year to a year and a half, and some experts have said it could take several years, particularly if you factor in production, and there's also a chance that you just don't get a vaccine, is the Prime Minister effectively saying that unless that happens, we aren't going to have life as it was pre-coronavirus?
So there are only three ways out of this crisis. One is a vaccine. The second is some combination of drugs that would enable you to avoid it. Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, was pointing out how PrEP basically it means that people can take that and that prevents them from contracting HIV/AIDS, that, you know, some combination of drugs like that, or herd immunity. Now, all three of these are infuriatingly far away. So far, even in New York City, which has been so badly hit by this, they think that antibody tests suggest that only 21% of people have the virus. You need people responsible for 60% of all social interactions to have immunity, for herd immunity to begin to work. On the combination of drugs, we haven't yet. There are some hopeful signs, and interestingly, Matt Ridley wrote in The Spectator last week that he thinks that there's a better chance of finding a cure, in inverted commas, than a vaccine. And then there is the vaccine. And why this is so important, I think you see this when you see the government's plans for getting workplaces back up and running. You see how different that is from how any workplace existed normally. It's not just the ban on hot desking and sharing pens and all that stuff. It's the fact that they are actively going to discourage face-to-face meetings, at which point people might wonder what the point of going back to work is. You know, obviously, this is more designed with manufacturing and construction in mind than journalism. But I think the challenge now is to try and find something that allows a return to normality, and the vaccine may well be the best bet for that. And thanks to the remarkable research being conducted at Oxford University, the UK finds itself in the vanguard of that work.
Fraser, are you optimistic that a vaccine is the route out?
I'm pretty sure that a vaccine is not going to be our route out of lockdown. We simply can't wait that long, and the rest of Europe isn't waiting that long. We can look at France, Italy, Germany. They're all starting to restart their economies now. Now, of course, this isn't back to the status quo ante, because we need to see how the virus responds. But I think there are two models that Britain can choose between. One is the South Korea model, where you collect data, you do track and tracing, and you use apps to try to stop the virus re-emerging. The other is the Swedish model, where you just ask people to be careful and you try to minimise the disruption. Now, what's significant is that the Swedes have now managed to measure their R number. The R number is what the government says is the most important metric, the rate at which the virus spreads. If the R number is below 1, that means the number of new cases are falling and lockdown is working. At least that's what we in the UK have been told. But the Swedes, after rejecting lockdown, have also managed to calculate that their R is 0.85. which is about the same as we think it is in Britain. They've done this without anything like the same amount of mandatory restrictions and economic curtailment that's gone on in Britain. This raises a very interesting question. Might the obvious next step for Britain simply be moving to a common sense level like Sweden and dropping the mandatory aspect of it, but relying on the innate caution of the British public to keep things under control?
James, for the time being, however, the government is definitely not thinking about the Swedish model. Their eyes are set very firmly on the South Korean model. And today we're expecting to hear more details of how test and trace will be rolled out. We have a pilot scheme taking place in the Isle of Wight. For a suggestion of how that might go, do check out Freddie Gray's blog on Coffeehouse. But James, is test and trace seen as the, at the moment, seen in government as the holding pattern, I suppose, the thing that you do until you get a vaccine?
So, yes. I mean, I think the government's plan is to drive the number of new cases and the R number as low as possible, and then use track, test and trace to try and stay on top of the virus. So essentially, if you got an outbreak somewhere, you could lock that specific place down while the rest of the country carried on as normal. Now, Fraser was talking about following the example of other European countries as they come out of lockdown, and that is undoubtedly true, because no one really knows what the effect on the R of taking certain measures, like, for example, reopening schools is. Everyone in Whitehall is watching to see what happens in those European countries that are doing those things. But I think the point is that getting back to normal, as in a world where people can go and stand in a crowded bar, or you can eat in a restaurant with the next table just 2 or 3 feet away, or you can fly on a budget airline where the person in the seat next to you is basically sitting on your lap. All of those things, right, that is going to require something. Either that is going to require a greater willingness to live with the virus and just rely on expanded health capacity, or that is going to rely on something like a vaccine, a cure or herd immunity. And I think this is the interesting question to watch, which is, you know, let's imagine what the economy looks like in a world where you have to socially distance. It's a very different economy from the one we currently have.
Fraser, the other piece of news in the papers today relates to the idea of immunity passports. Now, this is something we've heard of before, but I think there had been a sense that that idea had been vetoed. Now, the point of an immunity passport in theory is that if you have a successful antibody test, and there's increasing optimism that these tests are improving, they could soon be easy for all to access, then you could work out who had previously had coronavirus, and those people could perhaps return to the workforce first. Now, there's a report in The Guardian that discussions are underway as to how to make this work in a tech way to make sure everyone could have immunity passports who needed them. Can you see this as something the government would seriously consider when it comes to ways to ease the lockdown, get more people out from their homes?
Well, I think the government has been considering it. I think the Prime Minister himself has raised the prospect of those who do acquire the virus being able to get back to work, in his words. Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, has also raised the prospect of wristbands that can be used to identify those who have had the virus and are immune. Now, that might have sounded fine in theory, but when you think about the practice of it, are we really going to have a system where a privileged sort of 3 or 4% of the country don't have to obey lockdown where the rest of us do? Are you going to get to a situation where young people who so far have been trying not to get the virus following government's instructions might actually try to get it if that means that they can go back outside, live their life, start socialising, start working as normal? Kate Andrews has just written a quite persuasive argument against immunity passports for our Coffee House blog. And she's saying that even if a tech works, which is a big if, the ethical issues ought to make this simply a non-starter. And I think we're going to see a lot of this right now. The medical advances do raise lots of things that are technically possible, but they're ethically, I think, objectionable, certainly for a country like Britain. So our trend of copying China, and which we certainly have done when it comes to lockdown, I think is unlikely to be extended when it comes to the notion, which they're apparently looking at, of having cameras which can take pictures of you and recognise if you are immunologically approved or not.
Now, for those listening at home, thinking about when they might be returning to an office, James, you touched on earlier in the podcast some of the measures that are being discussed when people do eventually return to work, one being that you shouldn't share your pen. We know that Boris Johnson has been considering various options over the weekend. Departments, particularly Bayes, the business secretary, have been consulting and working out what you need specifically by each sector. We're not going to get the full outline of the roadmap going forward until Sunday, but there are government draft documents. So what are we looking at in terms of the speed, do you think? And is it the case, for example, that these things are actually that feasible in practice? You mentioned the idea that you could return to work, but you shouldn't really hold meetings with everyone. But there's also a suggestion that you might be allowed to be closer than 2 metres. That could be relaxed. So how functional is this going to be?
So it is worth remembering what the guidelines at the moment say. They say you should work from home if you possibly can, and you should only go into work if you can't work from home. It doesn't say don't go to work, but I think most people interpret it as don't go to work, and lots of places shut down. I think one thing that is you are seeing, you're already beginning to see more and more construction sites starting back up again. And I think the government would also like to encourage manufacturing to get going again. And so I think if you look at these rules, that's the kind of way to think about it. Now, this 2 metre distance, you know, I always think it's fascinating when you read reports from other countries. Some other countries have gone for 1.5 metres rather than 2 metres. I think there is also particular challenges around those bits of the economy, London and Birmingham in particular, where most people get to work via public transport. Because how do you stagger people coming in so that you don't cause big problems? But I think when you read the details of these government documents, which have gone out to consultation with various business groups, what you see is just how far off, even if offices return, how far off the kind of pre-corona world it will be. And it's hard not to think that that is going to have a knock-on effect on productivity, on overheads for businesses. If, for example, it's a remarkable thing that Amazon's profits, despite all the extra money they'd been making during this crisis, went down in the last quarter because of the cost of having to put in social distancing measures. I think that is a reminder of just how expensive these measures are going to be. But I think they're obviously going to be necessary in terms, both in terms of workers' health, but also one of the big challenges is persuading people that it is safe to go back outside. We know that even once the lockdown is lifted, polls suggest that 7 in 10 people will be very wary about leaving their homes.
This is why I think that the Swedish model would work in Britain, because the big question is whether you can trust a public if you simply say to them, will you please take care? Sweden's hunch all along was that it would work. The Imperial College model thought there were either two choices, either things carry on as normal or the government mandates a lockdown. But I really do think that the government should take seriously the idea that if you were to lift the legal restrictions and simply ask people to take care for a week, 2 weeks, then they probably would do. The Swedish word for this is folksvett, which means common sense. Common sense is a commodity, I think, which the population of this country possess in abundance. And I think a country that raised almost 750,000 volunteers for the NHS could be, I think, expected to observe proper social distancing without having the police on their tail if they don't.
Now, finally, we've had reports over the weekend of perhaps the opposition within the Tory party as to some of the things that we've been discussing. Clearly, the Prime Minister decided to go a very cautious approach. I think you could say that the doves of the cabinet are the ones who would be most happy with the pace at which is being projected here. But you had Andrew Griffiths, the Conservative MP, who was a former business advisor to Boris Johnson in Number 10, suggesting that the UK had to be careful not to be left behind, because every day another country is open for business and the UK isn't, you are going to potentially lose business. And then secondly, today you've had Steve Baker, formerly of the European Research Group, calling on Boris Johnson to end the absurd, dystopian and tyrannical lockdown. James, is this going to cause the Prime Minister much bother?
As I said in the magazine, the issue currently available on all good newsstands, I suggest a journey out to buy the Spectator.
You want to make that
essential.
Your daily exercise duty?
Yeah. One of the party management problems for Boris Johnson is he is nearly all nearly every Tory MP I have spoken to wants a substantial easing of the lockdown. Boris Johnson isn't going to deliver that when he addresses the nation on Sunday night. And that is going to cause attention. You know, it's not just the backbenchers. I think about two-thirds of the cabinet want a substantial easing of the lockdown. And I think this is going to be one of the big challenges for him, is that Tory MPs are becoming more and more worried about the economic costs of the lockdown. Now, we talked about public opinion, but what Tory MPs keep saying to me is they keep getting pleading phone calls from businesses in their constituencies saying, even with all the government support, they are going to run out of money in a few weeks' time if things aren't eased up. And I think that there is mounting concern about the economic costs of the lockdown. And I think the Andrew Griffiths point you made is a key one. I mean, one of the things that people worry about is, it's one thing if the entire European economy is locked down, but if you end up in a situation where other countries are opening up and the UK isn't, particularly in things like manufacturing, you will find that people go and source their supplies elsewhere. So I think Boris Johnson undoubtedly has a party management issue on his hands. Now, I think it, in some ways, we're not seeing it in its full force, the problem, because Parliament isn't physically, only a certain number of MPs are allowed into the Commons Chamber at any one time. So you're not seeing quite the full force that you would see if Parliament was sitting as normal. But I definitely think that when, in the run-up to Boris Johnson's address on Sunday, and particularly after it, there is going to be quite a big party management issue for him in terms of maintaining Tory support for his approach.
I have a sense this week that Tory backbenchers are beginning to get a lot more emboldened about criticising the lockdown strategy. You had this Steve Baker's article in the Telegraph over the weekend was pretty strongly worded. And I think you're beginning to get a lot of them questioning the science, questioning the rationale, asking to see the evidence that this current strategy is working. There are quite a few politicians who argue, correctly in my view, that the job of Parliament is to scrutinise decisions made by government, and there isn't much scrutiny going on right now. Of course, Parliament isn't properly sitting, but that isn't to say that politicians can't get together and organise themselves in groups. There's even some talk of a COVID research group being set up in the same way that a China research group is being set up. A bunch of MPs who would get together and start to compare notes, scrutinising the studies that the government is relying on and looking at the effect of lockdown in other European countries. So it could be that Parliament is starting to come back as a factor in the national debate. This is as to be expected. In the first days, it felt like a national crisis. Even the opposition was behind the government. I think we're beginning to see more debate now, both from the Labour Party and from Tory backbenchers.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.
Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by the Rathbones Look Forward podcast. Join the world's leading thinkers, writers, and scientists discussing the future of our ever-changing world. In the latest episode, historian Tom Holland talks to broadcaster Andrea Catherwood on the future of morality. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.